Hello, I'm Mike Armstrong. This is number 0701, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0701. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Michael Bowker, who's had a career as an investigative journalist, is the CEO of 60 Degrees Publishing, and the author of Michael Bowker's No Ordinary Days. He interviewed thousands of people, including the Golden State Killer. Why give publicity to a heinous murderer?
He did many other things besides kill people, and there were other victims. And I talked to them. It was after talking with them that I went ahead with the story because they wanted me to. They wanted to have their say. And I always made sure that a great deal of the stories, including sidebars, were always dedicated to them, how they've dealt with this, what happened, and what their state of mind is now, how they gained the strength to get past this so they can help others who have the same thing.
Musician Chris Jackson is one of the co-hosts of the amazing podcast The Spoon, but his day job is the head cider maker at Treasury Cider in upstate New York. How did he become a cider maker?
Apples, quite honestly, were a novelty to me in the best way possible. I'm a big culinary person. So I've just always kind of had an interest in food, and I'd made beer before, but I'd never really dealt with cider, and apple trees were interesting. I did it a handful of times with a friend and really enjoyed it. It was a very nice mix of science. I do have a master's degree in environmental engineering, and it's got a lot of creativity and the culinary thing. So I decided at that point that was something I wanted to attempt to pursue.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and if you like the movie Election, then check out my review of its literary sequel on Book Banter. So whatever happened to Tracy Flick? Find out later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0701, was global national reporter Mike Armstrong, who is an excellent reporter and an even nicer person. He was a former colleague of mine back when I was a global anchor. Thank you very much, Michael, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Early on January 14th in Monterrey, Mexico, 32-year-old Carlos Alonso allegedly broke a glass door at Christ the King Parish and entered, intending to rob the church.
You're going to go straight to hell.
But as he tried to flee with a statue of St. Michael the Archangel in hand, he tripped and fell on the angel's sword, seriously wounding his neck. Passers-by saw the injured Alonso and called for help. He is expected to be charged after he recovers from his fall. The statue was unharmed. Once again, the Lord works in mysterious ways. And while we're on the topic of how mysterious the Lord is, let us take a brief moment to honor the passing of Lucille Randon, who was known as Sister André. She was a French nun who was believed to be the world's oldest person, but had been reportedly growing weary of the burdens of age.
I'm going insane here. All these people do is work and pray. Work and pray, that's all they do.
She died a few weeks before her 119th birthday at a nursing home in southern France. That is a long, 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 long time to be saving yourself for God.
She's a model of generosity, virtue, and love. You have my word for it, she is a nun.
Whom among ye can go over a century without sex?
I've got two words for you. Bless you.
Hey, I'm just asking a question. Anyway, after getting into a dispute with staff at Shanghai's Jinling Purple Mountain Hotel on January the 10th over a misplaced laptop, a 28-year-old man named Chen decided to escalate. He crashed his car through the glass lobby doors and careened around the space, knocking over fixtures and terrifying other guests who tried to get the driver out of the car. "Do you have any idea what you've done? Are you crazy? Are you?" Onlookers screamed at him. As he attempted to exit the lobby, he hit a doorframe, came to a stop, and police took him into custody. It turns out the laptop had been stolen and was found outside the hotel. No one was injured. Wow. Molehill? Meet Mountain. Carrier pigeons have been couriers of legitimate and nefarious items for centuries, but officials at the Pacific Institution in Abbotsford, B.C., nonetheless were stunned when a gray bird with a tiny backpack landed in a fenced inmate prison yard on December 29th. Officials had to corner it, according to John Randall, Pacific Regional President of the Union of Canadian Correctional Officers. "You can imagine how that would look, trying to catch a pigeon," he said. After some time, they were able to grab it and remove the package, which contained about 30 grams of crystal meth. Said Randall, "We've been focusing so much on drone interdiction, now we have to look at, I guess, pigeons again." Ah, yes. The more things change, the more they stay the same. They set the little guy free, by the way, and are investigating its origin. What, no squab recipes? An unnamed 62-year-old man from Garfield Heights, Ohio, was arrested for the 70th time in early January after he allegedly stole a shopping cart full of packaged meat to sell to restaurants. The Walmart in South Euclid alerted authorities to the theft. In the parking lot, the thief transferred the goods to a stolen suitcase and threw what wouldn't fit into a dumpster. He told officers he sells the meat half price to area restaurants. He was booked again for theft. "For the love of God, please keep this guy out of the prison kitchen. And by the way, 70 arrests? They must have a punch card for him." And finally, in this section of Stuffall News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuffall program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's an update to a story that we shared with you on the show last year back in June. You may remember that Geico Insurance was stuck with paying a $5.2 million judgment to a woman identified only as M.O. in court papers after she contracted HPV from unprotected sex inside a car owned by her boyfriend, which was insured by Geico. The Missouri Court of Appeals upheld the verdict, but the state Supreme Court ruled unanimously to overturn it and sent the case back to a lower court. The man was considered liable because he didn't tell her he had the STD. So Geico is off the hook, but I'm guessing the boyfriend is not.
If you taste something bad, you want someone else to try it. It's what you do.
I can't get the taste out of my mouth.
If you want to save 15% or more on car insurance, you switch to Geico. It's what you do.
Shh.
Well, that sounded slightly pornographic. By the way, is that a gecko in your pocket, or were you just glad to see her? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuffall program, shall we? Michael Bowker is the author of Michael Bowker's No Ordinary Days. It's a collection of tales from his storied career in investigative journalism. During his career, he has interviewed celebrities, athletes, adventurers, several presidents, and even serial killers. He has narrowly escaped mountain lions and exploding volcanoes and been up close and personal with the Golden State Killer. Michael joins us via Zoom from California. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Peter. Thank you very much for inviting me on today. This is going to be fun.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So you've had, as I mentioned, a storied career. I bet when you first started in journalism, you didn't anticipate all the things you would end up doing, or did you?
Ah, boy, I have to go back a ways to remember exactly what I was thinking at that point. I had a lot of fun. I started on a small newspaper up in Northern California We were between Lake Tahoe and Sacramento. So there were whitewater rivers and skiing and hiking. And that's what really drew me there. Journalism was, it was there, it was important, but I really loved the outdoors. But as you know, as time goes on and you start getting involved with these stories, you're going, holy cow, there's so many exciting, interesting things to do. So it kind of, it just pulled me in that way.
I mentioned people like the Golden State Killer. It's interesting when you talk to people who are criminals in a certain way, because it's interesting to get their story, but is it also a double-edged sword where you're giving someone publicity that maybe they shouldn't receive?
Yeah, that is a great, great question. And I noticed that you were involved with Case Files as a writer in the past. So I know you've had some, you know, interaction with this and probably thought about that yourself. I talk to the victims, and you wonder what victims from a guy named Golden State Killer, but he did many other things besides kill people. And there were other victims, many hundreds. And I talked to them. It was after talking with them that I went ahead with the story, because they wanted me to. They wanted this out. They wanted to have their say. And I always made sure that a great deal of the stories, including sidebars, were always dedicated to them, how they've dealt with this, what happened, and what their state of mind is now, how they gained the strength to get past this so they can help others who have the same thing. So there were some real positive things to be gained from this story, besides just the story of the killer himself.
I also mentioned you narrowly escaped mountain lions, and I'm just wondering why you were even near them in the first place.
That's a really good question. Well, I grew up outdoors, and I'm still to this day more comfortable outdoors than I am inside. The story I did, I worked for the LA Times for a period of time doing lots of different stories. And there, I knew that the question had come up, how many mountain lions are there in California? Should we be encouraging their population growth, discouraging it? All the farmers, of course, thought that. But there was a question because they're so secretive. Native Americans called them spirit of the mountain. So I went with two trackers up into the Sierra to what they were doing was putting radio collars on them and trying to figure out what is their territory, how many are there, what is their lifestyle. So I went with them, and they weren't too pleased that I was there hanging out with them, because they thought I'd slow them down or scare the mountain lions away, or I would scare the mountain lions. I'm not sure what they thought, but they weren't too happy. So they bring dogs, and the dogs tree mountain lions. Even a small dog will scare a lion, which is interesting to me. But so they surrounded this mountain lion around a tree, and she was up there looking very frightened. And I said to one of the trackers, doesn't look like that big mountain lion that we all see on TV all the time. That's real scary. And he goes, nope. And he spits into the ground. He says, hold on a minute. And he went over to his partner, and kind of secretly, they pulled the dogs away so that there was a pathway right over my head. And the mountain lion took advantage of it right away and just jumped over my head and ran up the mountain. And I remember all the hair on the back of my head stepped straight up. And all of a sudden it got real dark because this mountain lion is jumping over me. And they came over to me and said, well, what do you think now? And I said, guys, I think I owe you a beer. That was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had.
We have two different definitions of cool, by the way. I'll just tell you that right now.
Well, they kind of accepted me after that. And so we got to hang out and, we talked, we camped out and had some beers and talked long into the night about what their experiences with the lions have been. So I got a good story out of it and was able to, it was a full page feature in the Times. So, but it was more than anything, I was able to give people an idea of what the mountain lion population is like. What do they need? How do they live? Are they endangered? And that kind of thing. So it was a good story to do.
Being an investigative journalist is not the same as being a simple beat reporter with a deadline, a daily deadline of the who, what, when, where, and how, or why, I should say. And you, as an investigative journalist, you do a deep dive into stories, and spend some time with them before you end up writing whatever piece it is you're going to write. What's it like in that situation with a deadline that could take a while before you see results?
Peter, I can tell that you're in the industry yourself because you ask really good questions, and I appreciate that. You do have to figure these things out. And part of it is the economics of it, because you've got to turn out a certain number of stories. So you start giving yourself deadlines, how often you have to get these stories out, how much interviewing can I do? And you just go blitzkrieg. You go as fast as you can. You talk to as many people as you can. You get out there and get involved. One story I did, it was one of the darker stories, as it turns out, that I've ever done. And it involved a guy who wanted to commit suicide on this 80-foot high bridge. And he didn't. That wasn't the dark part of the story. But I went out there where he was, scared myself half to death. I'm not a real fan of heights. But it gave me the feel, what was this all about? Because there were other people out there trying to help him. And so you try. I did a book in Montana one time about workers who were being exposed to lethal things in the mine itself. And the company was not telling them and did not tell the entire town. And I went into the mine itself when I wasn't really supposed to. But you kind of have to get in there and be part of it before you can really understand and write about the feel of it. You can write about the facts of it, but I've always hoped to get the feel of things. And I've done both. I've done beat stories where you're covering the city council or the whatever. I worked in the state assembly in California for a while too. But the investigative stories are so much more fun. They're so much more powerful and deep. And you're spending time with people, finding out how this event really affected their lives. I don't know. It's tremendously satisfying in that way, because you feel like you get at the truth better.
Today, these days, you actually run a company that's a publishing company. And you yourself have written more than 20 books. As a journalist, you have done some real stories. As a writer, as an author, you have also written some fiction. I just want to know, is that like a different muscle, a different part of your brain that can go from one to another? Is it a different writing process for you?
It is. It is in many ways. I wrote for Reader's Digest for about 10 years, and I would do their lengthy original stories. They were sometimes 8,000-10,000 words long. And dealing with those editors, it's funny because I've done stories in the New York Times, the LA Times, but by far the hardest to write for is the Reader's Digest. People think that's the formulaic writing. It's just the opposite. So I did learn some things about dialogue, pace, that kind of thing. But writing fiction is a different animal. What's really, really fun about writing fiction is that you get to create it from the ground up. With nonfiction, of course, you have to stick to the facts. But fiction, the facts are whatever you decide they are. But you're trying to tell the truth. The book of fiction I wrote is called Gods of Our Time. And the kicker underneath that is more than just a Paris love story. It's set in 1925, and a journalist goes there to interview Hemingway and Picasso and Gertrude Stein and other authors, which he thought were going to be the gods of his time. And they didn't turn out to be that way. And the other character in it is a female who lived through World War I and watched her family perish in some incidental bombings and things, and has to come back to Paris and figure out whether she can trust the world again and whether she can love again, because the world can get pretty savage at times. So these two meet in the most unlikely way. And it's about that. But my character interviews Hemingway and Picasso, two of my favorite. Peter, this was so much fun. And you've interviewed a lot of famous people in your career. And you'll know that each one has a character that they bring. And you can bring out that character when you interview them. I think I got Hemingway in this interview because I've read so much about him. And that was one of the most fun things I've ever done, was pretend I was sitting there interviewing Ernest Hemingway when he's 26 years old in Paris. And then the main character interviews Picasso as well. And Picasso said, and he actually said this, that writers tell the truth in order to expose a lie. And painters paint a lie in order to expose the truth. Now that gets pretty, I don't know, ephemeral, airy-fairy in a way, but it's kind of cool because writers do try to tell the truth and expose somebody trying to perpetrate a lie on the rest of us, right? Whether it's a serial killer or a bad politician, whatever it is. And then the painter is painting whatever, you know, like an impressionist painting. That's not a real portrait of what they see. But in painting the imaginary and painting the impression, he or she is trying to show the truth. So anyway, I found it an interesting quote. So I got to play with that. But anyway, they end up as characters in the book, but the two fictional characters are by far the two strongest characters in that book. It's a lot of fun. Gods of Our Time. It was as much fun, Peter, as I've ever had writing that novel.
Well, whether you're writing fact, as in Michael Bowker's No Ordinary Days, or fiction, as in Gods of Our Time, it's all fascinating. Michael, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, Peter, I appreciate it very much.
Michael Bowker, author of Michael Bowker's No Ordinary Days, and also his recent fiction title, Gods of Our Time, A Paris Love Story. He's also the CEO of 60 Degrees Publishing. And by the way, if you have a great idea for a book that is inside of you, he might be the person who would be helpful in getting that idea out. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0701, and you'll find the link to Michael's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on The Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's finger-licking good, if you're into that sort of thing.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Chris Jackson, who is a musician. He's also the co-host of a great, great podcast called The Spoon. And his day job, which we'll be talking about, is to be the head cider maker at Treasury Cider in upstate New York. Also, Stuart Nolman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. We have an idiot of the day coming your way, and much more in Stuff File News right here, right now. It's important to encourage your children in their scholastic endeavors, but an unnamed mother in LaGrange, New York, took parental support too far when she snuck into Arlington High School on January 17th before school started to watch her freshman daughter beat up another girl. Mom was caught on video using vulgar language and egging her daughter on as the girls tussled. Superintendent Dr. Dave Moyer said the woman blended in with the students, coming to school by wearing a backpack. Said Moyer, the students and the mother involved will be held accountable for their actions. Really? Will Mom be getting a detention? Does she have to clean the chalk erasers after school? Can you tell how old I am by that last statement? A patrolling police officer in Broadview Heights, Ohio, pulled over a suspected drunk driver who admitted to having had two or three beers. Well, he later admitted he had maybe three or four. During sobriety testing, the officer asked the driver to walk a straight line. The driver said he could do better than that and successfully performed a backflip. That's good, man, the officer said. I can't do that. But you still need to walk a straight line. Said the driver, as he was slurring his words, to me, I picture a straight line compared to your straight line. It would be obscured. That was enough for the officer. He arrested 27-year-old Tanner Watson on suspicion of driving while intoxicated. That upset Watson, who demanded to know what proof the cop had that he was drunk. Said the cop, "You can't tell me what a straight line is. I think that's pretty solid proof." Oh, I think that cop is going far in life. I also think Tanner Watson is not. Chicago, Illinois, Alderman Derek Curtis was teaching a concealed handgun carry class in Ashburn, and his son and daughter were attending. According to investigators, Curtis's son was handing a Glock 19 to his sister when it went off, shooting the 25-year-old daughter in the leg. She was hospitalized in good condition. This isn't Curtis's first time dealing with an accidental shooting. Last year, he shot himself in the hand. Curtis said he was helping a neighbor with a gun, which had been malfunctioning at a gun range. In that incident, according to Curtis, he had cleaned the gun and it went off as he was reassembling it. Yeah. Sometimes kids should not follow in their parents' footsteps. Also, may I remind you that this alderman was teaching a concealed handgun carry class, and to date, three members of his family in the last year have been involved in accidental shootings. This is a family that is literally gunning for a Darwin File starter kit. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Georgia man who was busted for shoplifting at a Walmart found himself in even more trouble when officers found 37 pounds of marijuana in his trunk. 28-year-old Marcus Rashad Tull was arrested at a Morgan County Walmart after he was accused of skip-scanning items in the self-checkout lane. A Walmart police officer told police that Tull had skipped at least 24 items totaling around $165. After Tull was arrested, officers opened his trunk and found three duffel bags full of vacuum-sealed bags of marijuana totaling 37 pounds. Police said that was the largest marijuana bust in the department's history. Tull has been charged with possession of marijuana with the intent to distribute, theft by shoplifting, and possession of drug-related objects. The moral of this story, boys and girls, is when you commit a crime, try to commit one crime at a time. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Chris Jackson is one of the co-hosts, along with Robbie Riss and Tom Bowers, of the excellent weekly podcast, The Spoon. You may have heard me talk about it on a few occasions. In addition to being a musician, Chris is also the head cider maker at Treasury Cider in upstate New York. That is what we are talking about now. He joins us via Zoom from Fishkill Farms. Hi, Chris.
Hello. How are you, Peter?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
So you've got so many things going on, but I know you've talked a lot about making cider. So let's go back to the beginning a little bit. And how did you come to this world or this point in your life where you're making cider?
Yeah, I feel like I've done this several times throughout my life, but 10 years ago, almost to the day, Facebook informed me, I was driving from Los Angeles to upstate New York to live with my now wife, who was here training to be a helicopter pilot. So there's a lot already happening in this story. But I'm driving here, and I was involved with music, of course, in Los Angeles, but I was also involved in the licensed fine art world, dealing with Star Wars and Disney and whatnot, and all very cool stuff, but not really an option in the Hudson Valley of New York, which is where I am, which is, as you said, Fishkill's where the farm is, but I'm Poughkeepsie, Kingston. Those are cities nearby that people probably recognize. And I got here and couldn't really find a job, day job, so to speak, that fit in with what I wanted to do. And I had made beer before, and apples, quite honestly, were a novelty to me in the best way possible. I'm a big culinary person, as Peter knows from listening to us on The Spoon. So I just always kind of had an interest in food and beverage. I'd made beer, like I think I said that, but I'd made beer before, but I'd never really dealt with cider, and apple trees were interesting. So I said, I'm going to try to make cider. And I did it a handful of times with a friend and really enjoyed it. It was a very nice mix of science. I do have a master's degree in environmental engineering. I told you this story takes a lot of turns. So I do have a science background that I did that for a bit, and it's got a lot of creativity and a culinary thing. So I decided at that point that was something I wanted to attempt to pursue. So that's kind of the genesis, if you will.
And for the uninitiated, the difference between, say, apple cider and apple juice, from what I understand, one is pasteurized and filtered and the other is not?
You know, it's a little gray, to be honest with you, Peter. I mean, I think in the traditional sense of the word, cider should really always refer to an alcoholic beverage is kind of what I've sort of been led to understand. Now, that doesn't mean that's the case really anymore. I would say probably pasteurized comes into play, and probably filtered. You know, I feel like juice is always very crystal clear when you see it in the grocery store and whatnot. It's in glass bottles and you can definitely see through it. I mean, when you press apples, what comes out is not crystal clear whatsoever. It's very hazy. Light does not, you know, maybe translucent on a good day, but certainly not transparent the way juice is. So, you know, I think there's a lot of gray, which is true of a lot of cider, to be honest with you. And I can expound on that a little if you'd like, but that's kind of my understanding of the real difference.
Okay, so besides your educational background, the fact that you've been doing this now for the better part of a decade, what's the biggest thing you felt you've learned about apple cider or apples in general that you did not know before?
Well, just to be clear, I'm at about half a decade with it. I did not do this initially upon getting here, unfortunately for me, because what I did, I didn't really enjoy, and we don't need to go into that. But yes, I finally found something I like. Boy, what I learned is just how much hard cider, but I'm just going to keep calling it cider. Whenever, if I'm saying cider, I mean hard cider, because like I said, that sort cider is just really so much more than what probably 90% of the world really thinks it is. And I guess I shouldn't say the world, because Europe, I think, has a little better handle on it than we do. But cider is wine. Like, wine is to grapes as cider is to apples. Same process, same everything. Like, it's, you know, people think of cider like so many places, you know, grocery stores and whatnot, and even bars, they'll sell it next to beer. It has absolutely nothing to do with beer, but so many people, I think, put them in the same category. I've tried to do some wholesale sales of our stuff that really is meant to be served in a wine glass and a small pour. And there people are like, yeah, at this price, I can't pour, you know, the pint of this would be too expensive. And it's like, well, that's because it's not supposed to be poured in a pint. It's a small pour of, you know, wine-like, and it pairs well with food. And so I think that's really, to get to the long way to your answer your question, it's just really much more sophisticated and interesting than I think most people understand, based on, you know, what we've kind of been taught, quote unquote, by grocery stores and bars and, you know, whatnot.
I mentioned you're in upstate New York, which is not too far from where I am here in Canada, and therefore the weather is relatively the same. So that being said, when is the best, for lack of a better term, cider season? Or is there one?
Yes and no. Certainly the best time to come see us at Fishkill Farms is September and October. It by far is the most fall-like time, which is what I think people are looking for when they think of cider. Certainly, once again, doesn't need to be the case and shouldn't be. I drink cider year-round because there's definitely different. It pairs great with barbecue and all, you know, I mean, there's so many places where it can be done, but for a traditional hayride hot cider, we do that at the farm, you know, which people love, which is non-alcoholic, you know, donuts and all that. September, October is a beautiful time to come there. Now, that is also the reason being is apples varieties, they ripen anywhere from as early as August to, you know, early November even. So there's a pretty wide range there, but that's why September, October is that very sweet spot for apples, which I guess relates to the fact of why it probably would be considered the sweet spot for cider. But thankfully, my job is year round, because as soon as all of the picking stop, because we are a big farm that we do a lot of pick your own business, which really keeps the doors open and the lights on, as it were. All of those apples that were harvested then need to be pressed and made into cider immediately after all of those people have left. And there are a lot of people that show up there, and I'm very happy to see most of them go most of the time, to be honest with you.
Well, I was about to ask, is cider something that is considered available, at least from your area and your neck of the woods? Is it something that it's available year round?
100% true. Yes. I mean, fresh, we have it fresh, and I mean, it's amazing that how well apples store. I mean, you can come have an apple from that was from our farm in June, July, and it's pretty viable. Like, if you keep them cold enough, they last a very long time. So yes, we have cider, hard cider, available year round. We certainly run out of certain varieties, because we do probably, I think, 9 currently. But that's just because supply and demand. We have, of course, a lot of what we call dessert fruit, which is your standard grocery store stuff. But then we have quite a bit of cider specific varieties, which, you know, Ashmead's Kernel and Newtown Pippin and, you know, Harrison and Medai d'Or and crab variety, people's stuff that people are like, I never heard of those. And I'm like, well, because they don't really sell them to eat very, you know, terribly often. But so, yeah, we have it year round, with the exception of, like I said, we might run out of a few varieties that are popular and sell well. But, you know, it's always there.
And is the stuff that you sell at Fishkill's Farm, is it something that is available, or from Treasury Cider, I should say, is it something that is available beyond your neck of the woods? Can people get your cider elsewhere, both in the United States and even beyond?
Unfortunately, not currently. Yeah, it's the laws, as anybody who's dealt with any kind of, you know, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, whoever the hell came up with those, that trio. But, you know, the laws are very strange with all of that. So you can jump through hoops and get to a place where you can ship anywhere. Quite honestly, we haven't done it yet because we don't need to. As I mentioned, the farm does a tremendous pick-your-own business, and we have a very captive audience for what. So we do wholesale a little locally, and we can sell to anywhere in New York, but, you know, we're not set up to ship. And, you know, so many people are like, oh, do you ever get anything, you know, to Buffalo, which is 5-6 hours away? You know, if you want to come get it, you can, but no, we're not driving to Buffalo. So not currently, but we certainly do have, you know, the long range plan is to expand on things. So it's, you know, stay tuned, as it were.
One of the things I've always found interesting about listening to The Spoon, besides just listening to The Spoon, is the fact that when you talk about cider, there's a definite passion to this that you clearly have when you discuss it. I'm just curious to know, if you went back to your high school reunion and you were bumping into your classmates from when you were 16 and 17 years old, and they found out that you were making cider, would they go, what? Or would they go, well, that sounds like Chris?
Probably more the latter. You know, I think, I mean, I guess if it was literally somebody I hadn't seen since I was 16 or 17, they might be a little surprised, because I was a pretty good student and pretty, you know, excelled pretty decently with academia and especially math and science and whatnot. But, you know, again, if you think about it, that's why it does make sense, because there's such a science component, but there's also a real creative component. And I would play music in high school, and everybody knew that too. So, you know, I think anybody who was paying attention wouldn't be terribly shocked by it.
So. Well, it's a fascinating business that you're in, and people can go and look at the website, which is treasurycider.com. Maybe even make some plans to visit next summer or next fall, if that's what they want to do.
Most definitely. That's what I tell anyone to do. We have there's a great tasting room there, and it's an amazingly beautiful property. Very cool history, which I know you're a history person, Peter. It's over 100 years old. The original owner of the property was Robert Morgenthau, Henry Morgenthau, who then left it to his son, Robert Morgenthau, who Henry was friends with a local farmer, and they kind of got together and talked about farming. And then eventually that farmer said, well, I've been elected as president of the United States. Do you want to be the secretary of the treasury? Because that other farmer was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Mm. And that is why we're called Treasury Cider, which is pretty great. There were meetings at the farm with Churchill, Roosevelt, like crazy history has happened where I get to go to work every day, which is kind of cool too. And then his son, Robert Morgenthau, was the district attorney in New York City for ever. I think the show Law and Order is essentially based on him.
Yes.
So, you know, there's some pretty crazy history, and now it is owned by Josh Morgenthau, my boss and huge cider enthusiast. And there is a little confusion. I know you've even run into it a couple times there. Treasury Cider and Fishkill Farms are intertwined. It's seen somewhat as a separate thing, but it's really not. I mean, you know, I work for Fishkill Farms, but I happen to be one of the few people that's exclusively for Treasury Cider. So,
well, Chris, pleasure to talk to you once again. As I said, I listen to each and every week on The Spoon, and congratulations on the success of Treasury Cider.
Thank you very much, Peter. We appreciate you always always tuning in and joining us occasionally. And yeah, it was a pleasure to do it.
Chris Jackson, the head cider maker at Treasury Cider in upstate New York. You can also hear Chris on the weekly podcast, The Spoon. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0701, and you'll find links to both. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Hey, how would you like to become a patron of the Stuff File program? It's easy to do. By going to patreon.com and becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. If you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. Join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Coming to you from Canada, a place where fighting is frowned upon, unless it's on an ice rink. This is the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is once again talking about flicks, but it's a book. He'll explain. Stuart Nolman. How you doing, Stu?
Oh, fine, Peter. Vote for me for class president. Vote for me for class president. Welcome. You know, when I was in high school, I never did run for student council president, to be honest with you. I was too busy doing Reach for the Top.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
We've all seen the videos.
Yeah. Yeah, all that hair. But on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a literary sequel to a hit movie, which was, you know, based on a novel. Because sometimes in order to capitalize on a hit movie or movies, attempts are made to have literary sequels written and published to continue where the original story that inspired the hit movie left off. Now, examples that come to mind are the number of James Bond novels that were written by such authors as John Gardner and Raymond Benson since 1981, Scarlet, the literary sequel to Gone with the Wind that was published about 30 years ago, and Gump and Company, the novel that continued the story of Forrest Gump that was written by its original author, Winston Groom.
And by the way, by the way, Raymond Benson, a great friend of this show.
Yes, and because you're a Bond fan, there's that special attachment too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sometimes I call Ray to ask him for a little background to Bond, even though I'm pretty much up on the Bond canon, but he always has little nuggets and details that the rest of the world doesn't have, and I like to keep to myself.
Yeah. It's the hidden treasures. That's what it is.
Exactly. It's the hidden treasures.
Yeah, which, not even a Geraldo Rivera special can open that one.
Exactly.
Now, like their movie counterparts, Peter, these literary sequels were either quite good or quite forgettable, like Gump and Company. But when it comes to the latest example of the literary sequel, Tom Perrotta's Tracy Flick Can't Win is a continuation of his novel Election, which became a terrific movie in 2000 that starred Reese Witherspoon and Matthew Broderick. We can gladly say that it falls into the former category. The novel continues the story of Tracy Flick, the overly zealous and ambitious high school student who would do anything and at any cost to win the hotly contested election for student council president. The reader finds out how her life has turned out since that fateful school council election. It takes place 20 years later, in which Tracy, who possesses a law degree and a doctorate, is working as a vice principal at a public high school in New Jersey. She works hard at her administrative job, but feels mostly underappreciated. However, two events come up at Green Meadow High School that sort of perk things up for Tracy. First of all, the school is doing a Hall of Fame night and is chosen to head the committee to select the inductee or inductees. However, the shortlist of candidates is anything but worthwhile, so they end up selecting two inductees, Vincent Falcone, a school big man on campus and star of the football team, who ends up playing one season in the NFL, and front desk Diane, a longtime employee in the school office. And second, Mr. Weed, the school principal, announces his upcoming retirement and says that Tracy's the top candidate to succeed him. So in order to strengthen her position as the front runner to be the school's next principal, she continues her work on the Hall of Fame committee with great gusto. That is, until she discovers there's a competition for the job. And that's in the form of the school's highly popular former football coach who was embroiled in a scandal and was forced to resign in disgrace. Now, the novel's narrative is interchangeably told through the points of view of the main and secondary characters that fill this book, which gives it a multidimensional perspective. As well, Perrotta softens the hard edges of Tracy that were prevalent in Election to offer a more sympathetic portrait 20 years later, in which she endured a number of career disappointments and being a single mother raising a rather rebellious daughter. But in the end, Tracy Flick Can't Win is an enjoyable, heartfelt literary sequel that gives a sobering take on the maxim, you reap what you sow. There's plenty of dark humor and rapier wit that conceals a lot of cynicism and bitterness that's associated with paying your dues in life and having to deal with the many disappointments that life hands to you, whether you like it or not.
Mm. Now, I'm curious because you mentioned that some of these sequels to films are not necessarily of quality. You mentioned the Gump one.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, of the ones you mentioned, or of the ones that you know about beyond the ones you've mentioned,
yeah,
how many of them are written by the original author?
With the exception of Scarlett, because Margaret Mitchell died in 1949, for most part, I would say the majority. The only one that I haven't, the other one besides Scarlett, were the three or four Godfather's continuation books.
Right.
Because Mario Puzo didn't write another Godfather novel after the original was published in 1969.
So are you saying that the Gump one was written by the original author?
Yes, it was.
Wow. And you're saying it's bad.
Yeah. I mean, it was basically to capitalize on the success of the movie Forrest Gump. So it's almost like when you think of back in the 70s, those quickie paperbacks.
Yes,
that were
yes.
issued when a certain event happened.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's in that same vein.
Ouch. Okay. Yeah. So again, this one is?
It's called Tracy Flick Can't Win by Tom Perrotta. It's published by Scribner, and it's $32.99.
Now, I think I usually ask you at this point what other books you have in this genre, but I think you already described a few of them, unless you have more to share.
Yeah, well, there's, I say if you saw the movie Election and you want to read Tracy Flick Can't Win, suggest you read the book Election as well.
Ah, of course, the original, right.
Yeah, and also, I was thinking about this before the, while I was preparing this segment, the book Ghosts at a Watchman by Harper Lee, because it was billed as a sequel to Kill a Mockingbird, but the thing is, she wrote Ghosts at a Watchman before To Kill a Mockingbird. She wasn't happy with the way that book resulted, and she just started fresh and wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. But Ghost at a Watchman takes place later when Scout and Jem are adults, and Atticus Finch is an old man who has a touch of racism in him.
So it's a prequel, which is really a sequel, which is a prequel.
Yeah, so it's almost like Sideways in a way.
Yeah.
I was ruminating over this. I'm wondering what to make of this book. And, you know, it was confusing. It really was.
And for you to find a book confusing, you know, the author should start again.
Well, it's too late for Harper Lee.
Well, yes.
Yeah, she went to literary heaven.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Anyway, this week's book is?
Tracy Flick Can't Win by Tom Perotta. It's published by Scribner, and it's $32.99.
And where can we find you, in the prequel or the sequel?
Or maybe one of the in-between continuations, but not at the hallways of Green Meadow High School in New Jersey, that's for sure. But in the pages of the Montreal Times, just go to www.mtltimes.ca and I'm there.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Stuart.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter. And the bell's ringing. Class time. Can't be late.
And you better not be late, because I was a prefect. I will make sure you're not late. I don't want to write you up, mister.
No way.
Thanks, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, plus a few more Stuff File news stories right here, right now. A man entered a TD Bank in Orlando, Florida, wearing a black hat with the word police on the front and a pair of sunglasses. He handed the teller a note that had two words on it, assault and money. 2 days after absconding with an undisclosed amount of cash, the same man, wearing the same hat and the same sunglasses, went into a Circle K with another note. Give me all the money and a pack of 305s 100s, please. Police responded within 2 minutes and found 45-year-old Nicholas Zapater La Madrid outside the store with the stolen loot and the cigarettes. Police say he gave a full confession, explaining his reason for walking into his neighborhood Circle K to rob it. He was bored and has an impulse problem. Well, now he's going to find a whole new level of boredom behind bars, because I hear that lack of freedom can be quite dull. 42-year-old Leo Lamont Tony of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, ordered a pizza from Primo's Pizza about a kilometer away. The driver told police that when he began to walk away from the customer's apartment, Tony asked where his soda was. When the delivery driver didn't give his drink, Tony allegedly pulled the man inside and locked the door. The delivery man said he managed to escape by pushing Tony, fled the scene, and immediately contacted the Johnstown Police Department. Cops arrived at the apartment of the accused, who allegedly smelled of alcohol and had slurred speech. It's unknown if Tony, who goes by the name Pooker, actually ordered a beverage or if he just expected one to come with his pizza. Tony faces one count of false imprisonment. You know, where he's headed, he's going to learn the hard way that beverages don't come to your door, or should I say sell, either. And finally, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
You know, it was just last week that I warned against the plethora of a certain type of story that seems to be multiplying at a rapid pace, and here we are a week later with another one in the same category. A parolee was charged with 6 burglaries that happened through December and January on Rochester, New York's East Side. Rochester police identified 26-year-old Jamal Burden as the suspect using the GPS monitor he's required to wear and using video posted on a neighborhood social media app. Officers responded to a burglary at a home on January the 10th and discovered that Burden was there earlier, according to his GPS monitor. Officers went to Burden's home, searched the place where they found evidence linked to all six of the burglaries, and took him into custody. He was on parole for a 2016 conviction of criminal possession of a weapon. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're on parole and wearing a GPS monitor, would you rob houses in a neighborhood that has heavy surveillance presence via an app, and then take all of that loot directly to your own home? One reason, and one reason only: you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0701. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0701. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including KDXRadio.com, TrueTalkRadio.com, Over the Air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, WLSLLPFM in Dade City, Florida, KZZHLPFM in Eureka, California, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, CFMU in Hamilton, CKLU in Sudbury, Local 107.3 FM in St. John, CHSR in Fredericton, and also streaming on just about any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There are some things you just can't multitask.